Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives.
We're going to be talking about today a couple of things, but the main thing is trust. And certainly the ability to trust or not trust is something that impacts all of us in all of our relationships, personal, professional, you name it. Today we're going to be talking in particular about what to do when sexual integrity has been violated in a relationship. Today's guest is co-author Jason Martinkus. Jason, have I said your last name correctly?
That is exactly right. Good job.
Thank you very much. I'll hire me. Folks, Jason Martinkus is the co-author of Worthy of Her Trust, What You Need to Do to Rebuild Sexual Integrity and Win Her Back. Jason, welcome to Mind Talk. This is quite a title, quite a book.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, you know, a lot of times people write books and it's something that they may know about sort of philosophically or professionally or educationally, but not necessarily experientially. But for you, this book grows out of your own personal experiences.
That is exactly right. And the impetus for writing the book really comes from that, having been through the situation where I destroyed trust in our relationship and my marriage. In the beginning, when everything hit the fan, that was the question: how in the world will I ever rebuild trust and win her back? And now I see that in my office as a counselor. That seems to be the million-dollar question when people come in. So and, the impetus for writing it was really out of that personal experience.
And, you know, it's the impetus, as I said a few moments ago, in so many relationships. How can I trust this person? How do I know this person is safe? Now, for you, again, you're talking about sexual integrity and, at least for a while, the lack thereof. Your co-author, Stephen Arterburn, starts off the book with a plea that marriages stay together. He says, if you have a lifestyle that lacks in sexual integrity, you can heal. He says, shame is a cancer and one of the triggers to bring a man back into lust and unfaithfulness. So let's just start with there. I don't want you to read his mind. But staying together, shame is a cancer. Sexual integrity can be restored. Trust can be restored. Sort of walk us through, that's one thought, but it's sort of several thoughts as well. Can you kind of walk us through that concept?
Yeah, kind of. I'll start in a different place and connect back there.
Okay.
The lifestyle of that I lived, you know, lacking sexual integrity, including pornography, chat club or chat rooms, multiple affairs, emotional and physical. That lifestyle is a shame-based lifestyle. You know, when I lived that way, I hated myself. I hated looking in the mirror. And day in and day out, the shame perpetuated the sexual acting out. I hated what I did, and I hated who I was, and the way that I made that feel better was by acting out again, by engaging in another escapade, if you will. And all the while doing that, my wife had no idea. Mm. She knew something was wrong in our relationship. She knew there were issues, but she didn't know what I was really doing behind the scenes. And I think when Steve talks about the cancer, really what happens is these issues, the lack of trust, the lack of integrity, it eats away at the marriage from the inside out.
The idea that one can have a sex addiction, and you talk about porn, chat rooms, multiple affairs, You know, so often that concept is really sort of the fodder of comedians. And I think that folks have a hard time understanding that it can be, it is a real addiction that real people really struggle with. Can you talk about that for a bit?
I can. Boy, don't get me started on the soapbox there. the medical community doesn't recognize sexual addiction as a bona fide addiction. And in so many ways, I can understand why that might be. But ask somebody who has lived it, and they will tell you what a hellish prison it is. And for me, I wanted so badly to stop. I prayed, you know, to God for help to stop. I tried to do different things, strategies to stop. At one point, I was suicidal. You know, I almost drove my truck off a bridge one night because I wanted so badly to quit. And every time I swore it would be the last time, but, you know, days and weeks later, I would be right back into it. And as a defining characteristic of addiction, you know, the compulsion that you say you're going to stop, but you can't stop, you know, that defining characteristic is there when it comes to acting out sexually. And one other thing I'll say on that, when you kind of boil it down, it's not about the act of sex. It's not about engaging in sexual intimacy. It's about feeling loved, wanted, powerful, accepted, competent. It's about feeling those things that we get through the vehicle of acting out sexually.
When you have talked to other folks about sexual addiction, what kind of responses do you tend to get? Do folks, in your own work, I mean, do folks tend to get it, or do they give you an argument, or what happens?
It depends on if they're guilty or not.
Okay.
In my office, as a counselor, this is all I do in my practice, is deal with sexual integrity issues. What I try to do is take away the stigma of the addiction label and deal with the reality that the way we've used our sexuality or misused our sexuality has caused issues in our life. Caused issues between us and other people. It's caused issues in our marriages. A lot of guys that walk into my office have experienced some issues around their work because of it. And so whether or not somebody is quote-unquote addicted is less important than acknowledging it's a problem and it's hurting your life. It's hurting not only your life personally, the way you view yourself, but it's hurting the people around you as well. So when we start to have that conversation, most guys will acknowledge, yes, this is an issue.
Do you have any women in your practice?
As a rule for me, I don't see female sex addicts, but more and more I get the phone calls for it. A recent statistic showed about 30% of clicks on internet pornography sites were women. It is becoming more and more prevalent.
What do you think about that?
I think it's real life.
Okay.
I think it's real life. With the advent of the internet, this stuff is so easily accessible today. Anybody can go online at any time for no cost whatsoever, completely incognito, and find sexual stuff, whether that be in the form of reading material, pornographic pictures, chat rooms, video chats, that kind of thing. So the ease of accessibility makes it such that if somebody is susceptible, if somebody has that slight bit of temptation, there's a low barrier to entry today.
The idea that both men and women could be sexually addicted, again, you know, I'm sure there's some folks listening and they're experiencing some degree of pushback. But the fact remains that any addiction has anxiety in there somewhere. And I don't know that anyone is necessarily immune from feeling anxious. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to have an addiction. But I think if you put addictions in the framework of an anxiety-based experience, perhaps it's easier to understand. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. So like I said a few minutes ago, acting out sexually isn't about the act of having sex. Acting out sexually is about really twofold. It's medicating or coping with some of the negative stuff that goes on, like the anxiety, And then it also adds back. And that's something that's unique about sexual addiction is, you know, there's no other addiction on the planet that makes us feel, there's no other acting out on the planet that makes us feel the way sex does. Drugs can't do that. Alcohol can't do that. Food can't do that, although food is most similar to sex addiction.
Okay.
But with the anxiety that you're talking about, it'll take away the anxiety. It'll numb that pain, but it also adds back the feelings of love, connection, acceptance, and things like that.
As you were talking about the ways in which you were acting out, I note that you included emotional affairs. And as you know, a lot of folks say if there's not sex involved, it's just really not an affair and don't be such a fuddy-duddy. But you were very clear that an emotional affair was part of what you were doing that was not okay.
Absolutely. That's one of those things that culturally, I think what you said is exactly right. Culturally, a lot of people will say, if there's no physical contact, then nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
What I came to acknowledge for my life and my marriage was that the women that I was engaging with emotionally, even though there's no physical contact, the women I was engaging with emotionally, they were meeting a need in my heart. They were meeting an emotional need for connectedness and intimacy that I was depriving my wife of meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was keeping that part of my heart from her, and that's betrayal. And for the record, most wives that I talk to, whether there's been actual sex or not, when there's been an emotional affair, wives say it hurts just as bad.
Yeah.
It feels like the same level of betrayal.
Folks, you are listening to the voice of Jason Martinkus, who is the co-author with Stephen Arterburn of Worthy of Her Trust, What You Need to Do to Rebuild Sexual Integrity and Win Her Back. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Jason, I'd like to start with how you started, how you were first introduced to the world of sex and pornography. So folks, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. And we're back. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation on ways to rebuild trust in a relationship. Jason, how old were you when you first became aware of the world of sex and porn and all those things?
You know, I was about 11 years old when I was introduced to pornography. A friend of mine that I was playing with at the time showed me a hardcore pornographic magazine. And, you know, I think back, those images are still etched in my mind, you know, 3 decades later.
Hmm.
And I remember very distinctly when I saw those pictures, there was a strong feeling of electricity. You know, something inside me was awakened whenever I saw those pictures for the first time. And then there was also this little feeling of shame, little feeling of guilt.
Hmm.
Like I should do what I'm doing in secret. It was about the same time that I discovered masturbation as well, and then found pornography on our computers and television. And at that point, really for me, the slippery slope had started.
Okay.
It was only downhill from there.
Did your parents have any idea as to what was going on?
None that I know of.
Okay.
None that I know. You know, I would sneak around to watch TV after they had gone to bed. I'd come back downstairs and I would sneak AOL CDs from the mailbox before my father got them so that I could get, you know, internet access. So I was sneaky about it.
Okay. I remember those CDs that would come to give you free access to AOL. Gotcha.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Something happened in your life at the age of about 16, but from the age of 11 until 16, what kinds of activities did you typically engage in? Was it the movies and the magazines, or was there more?
So during that time, I was discovering my sexuality. I lost my virginity. And I watched a lot of pornography. That was the primary thing that I was into at the time. My dating relationships, once I had turned 16, my dating relationships were largely sexual from there on.
Okay.
And so it kind of ebbed and flowed. With sexual dating relationships, I didn't need the pornography as much. And without the relationships, I needed more of the pornography.
Okay. Did your folks talk to you at all about sex? And about sexuality? Did they prepare you for that world?
They did not. Okay. They did not. And I think in some ways my dad did the best he could with the conversation that went like this. Son, we need to talk about sex. Is there anything you need to know? and that was his attempt, and the best way he knew how, to have that conversation with me when I was, I don't remember, 12 or 13 years old. And the truth is, by that point, it was too late.
Wow.
For me.
Yeah.
I learned from my friends and the internet more than I was going to learn from him at that moment.
Okay.
And I think it's important to note, just for anybody that's listening, statistically today, the average age of introduction to online pornography is 7 to 9 years old for boys.
7 to 9 years old?
Yeah. Isn't that scary?
That's very, actually, Jason, I just want to interrupt because I want to make sure that you're speaking directly into the phone. I hear a shift in your voice.
Okay, sorry about that.
Okay. You're saying that the age of introduction to porn is 7 to 9?
7 to 9 years old online. And unfortunately, what some of the pornographers have done is they've actually taken websites that would be, let's say, fairly commonplace for a child to click on. And they'll take it and they'll slightly change it. They'll change the lettering or the wording just slightly so that if somebody accidentally types in that address, they land at pornography.
Gotcha.
People have done that around some of the most common words, if you will, or brands that are out there that are angled at kids.
I think my mouth is still open. I'm still stuck on 7 to 9. What about girls? You gave us the statistic for boys. Do you have one for girls?
I don't know it for girls.
Okay.
I don't know what it is for girls.
Do you have a sense of how old boys are when they first begin to be sexually active? What the latest research says?
I don't know what the research says on when their sexual activity begins. But I did recently read an article talking about how quickly they're introduced to hardcore pornography and violent sex acts.
Uh-huh.
And within a short time of being introduced to the online world, they're clicking on the sites that have some of the more graphic, really unfortunate websites depicting acts of sex that just... It's just so sad what young people are being introduced to and the concept of what that act should be.
You know, there is so much that is so sexualized in television and games and magazines and, sex sells, right? So they're being sexy about toothpaste or shoes or, nail polish. And it's kind of extraordinary. Do you worry about that?
I do worry about that. And part of... as you say that, I'm struck in remembering, as part of my recovery, it's been 11 years since I last looked at pornography or acted out sexually.
Okay.
And so today, my heart and my mind have changed. My heart and mind have changed to to see people as people and less as objects. And so today, I'm keenly aware of the hypersexualization of our culture. And as you said, we use sex to sell everything from toilets to toothpaste to cars to it's a function of what marketers know is that sex doesn't sell the act of sex. And here again, I go back to what I said earlier. Sex sells a feeling. It sells a sense of ourselves. And that's really what is so powerful about that.
It's very scary. We could talk about that for another 8 hours. So let me shift back. At 16, your life changed. What happened at 16?
At 16, two things were key at 16. I was dating a girl who was a Christian. She and her family would talk to me about Jesus, and it was through them that I came to give my life to Christ. Subsequently, she and I were sexually active, and she got pregnant when we were 16. For me, was a pivotal time, not only because my heart changed, but also with the change in my life relative to her being pregnant. And unfortunately, when I look back in hindsight, she ended up having a miscarriage, and I got out of that relationship and as far away from her as I could. And I use the word unfortunately because, in retrospect, I began then making vows to myself about how I was going to live my life. And one of those vows, whether I knew it or not, one of those vows was to live with secrets because I never told anyone about the pregnancy. It was also to run, to not face the problems that I had, but to actually run. And that lasted all the way until I blew up our marriage.
And when you say you blew up your marriage, can you talk about that? What happened? At some point, you met someone, you married her. You thought everything was going to be wonderful, or did you? I mean, did you have on your wedding day? Did you have a gnawing concern about your behaviors, or were you clear that it was all going to be okay?
Yeah, you know, I had this duplicity. I went into marriage thinking that it would fix me. You know, I thought once you're married, you have all the sex you want all the time, and everything was going to be carriers and rainbows. And, you know, obviously that's not the case. And I stood there at the altar on our wedding day with a guilty, guilty conscience. You know, I knew the secrets I had. She had no clue. And I just thought, we'll sweep these under the rug and hopefully we won't trip over it. And today, you know, my wife Shelley would tell you the story. It took her about 8 years to be willing to open our photo album from our wedding day. Because she couldn't bring herself to look back on what was supposed to be such a special moment, yet it was so fraudulent.
That sounds like a lot of pain on her end.
A lot of pain on her end. I think back over the pain that I've caused, and the hardest part for me today, after a lot of work, I mean, you know, we've been through a lot of work on this. The hardest part for me today is still forgiving myself for the damage and pain that I caused her. Those are hard moments.
Well, I can certainly understand that. And, you know, when you say you blew up your marriage, how did she find out what was going on?
So at the point where she confronted me,
confronted
me. And so at that point, we were a few years into our marriage. I had, at that point, I was deep in my addiction, spending days in a row awake, acting out online and offline, avoiding going to work. I actually got fired from a job because I wouldn't go to work. I just stayed in my apartment on my computer all day. So there came a point where she started to find the breadcrumb trail. There were credit card receipts and cell phone records and calls from these random people. And so she sat me down after I came in from a trip. And she said, tell me what went on with this particular woman that we both knew. And I lied several times. And then she said, I spent 2 hours on the phone with her. I know everything.
Wow.
That was the most intense moment of my life.
I would imagine. And this was someone that the two of you knew.
Yes, this was a coworker that she had met that I was having an affair with. And so after she confronted me, it took me a couple of days to actually come around. And I finally told her the truth. And at that point, I told her about that affair and the truth of that affair, as well as all of the others that I had had online, offline. It just came clean. And that was the pivot point for not only my healing, but our healing as a couple, to finally have the truth on the table.
You know, as you talk about it, you make it sound like there is truly a laundry list of affairs in which you engage. So it kind of sounds overwhelming for you to think back on, overwhelming for you to have lived, and certainly overwhelming for your wife to have listened to you talk about.
You know, it is. In some ways, it feels like a dream. And I hear this a lot from people who lived past lives of addiction. You know, it feels like a dream because at some point, and this is kind of the way I describe it for my life, there was a point where I was living my life trying to fit my addiction into my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything shifted and I began trying to figure out how to fit my life into my addiction. You know, it owned me from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed.
Literally.
Literally. And I would plan my business trips around it. I would plan meals around it. I would plan activities with my wife around it. So when we look back over, you know, all the pornography, all the chat rooms, there were 18 affairs. You know, when you look back over all of it, it is incredibly overwhelming. And I think that is also part of why it feels like such a powerful place today in recovery and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
To know that we were at such a low place, and now to see the redemption to such a better place.
You know what I think about folks who have come into my office, and there may be an affair or two. Certainly by the time there's a number three, if that's where it goes, that relationship is often, one of them is completely ready to leave. They're just coming in to sort of put the period on the relationship.
Yeah.
And you're saying that there were 18. So I wonder how and where in her spirit, if you can answer this, your wife was able to make the decision to stay and to participate with you in the really hard work of rebuilding trust.
You know, I think in the beginning, shock was a savior for a while.
Okay.
You know, I think she was in shock to the point where it was so overwhelming, and the guidance that she was getting was to wait, to watch and wait. Don't do a knee-jerk reaction and just go file, but watch and wait. And what that ended up looking like was 13 months into the process, she
okay.
forgave me.
Okay.
And then 18 months into the process, she decided to stay.
Okay. Up until that point, she was trying to decide for herself what she was going to do.
That's exactly right.
Makes sense. We're going to take
a year and a half.
We're going to take a break, folks. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, talking with Jason Martinkus, co-author with Stephen Arterburn of Worthy of Her Trust, What You Need to Do to Rebuild Sexual Integrity and Win Her Back. We will be right back.
Thank you.
we continue the conversation on rebuilding sexual integrity when the trust has been violated in a relationship. Jason, were there any children in the marriage at that point?
There weren't. We did not have any kids at that point.
Okay.
And you know, it makes it all the more pointed for me, where Shelley, if she were on the call, she would joke with you and say, I had every reason to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I had every opportunity to start over at that point. And today, she's thankful that she didn't. And today we have three little boys.
That's wonderful. I just want to ask you again to speak directly into the phone. Let's talk about the process of rebuilding, because early on in your book, you list all of these things that need to happen, and it's a pretty long list.
It is a hard, hard process, and not for the faint of heart. And for us early on, you know, that first year and a half when she was deciding whether or not to stay, it was a moment-by-moment thing. It was wake up every day wondering if today was the end of our marriage. And so the more that I could do to create a sense of security, the more that I could do to reduce her fear and anxiety of me going back down this path, the more trust got restored.
You say that in terms of the rebuilding process, you need time, energy, planning, vision, willingness, creativity. I'm almost running out of air here. Persistence, intentionality, patience, hope, and commitment. There are so many people who would hear that list, experience that list, and just decide that that's way too much work to do, that they're never going to be successful, and that the marriage is done, or the relationship is just done.
And that's what I said. In fact, for me, 9 months into the process, I went to my guys that were walking this with me, and I said, I'm out. I'm pulling the ripcord. We will never get through this. There's just no hope. And they helped me stay in the fight. They helped me stay in and keep working. In retrospect, that reality, that everyday pressure of, are we going to make it through this? Mm-hmm. At some point, that became a motivator for me. And I try to tell this to guys in my office, let the challenge be what you step to. But let this thing be the process in your life that shapes and molds your character, so that when you come out on the other side, yes, you have a restored and redeemed marriage, and that's fantastic, and we're hoping for that. But come out on the other side being a different man. And that's what I found for myself, is there's so much growing up and maturing and shaping and molding that needed to happen in my character. Mm. And this, frankly, was the process that God used to do it.
The idea, and again, I'm going to ask you to speak directly into the phone.
Oh, sorry.
The idea that trust has been violated, and the trust has been violated because of something that you've done, and your wife is, in theory, angry, she's upset, she's frightened, she's worried, she's got to think about her physical health. I mean, there are just so many things that are on her plate. Mm-hmm. I would think that she would go in and out of wanting to talk to you and wanting to throw you out the window.
That's exactly right. You know, wives, whenever this happens, wives go through a grieving process. You know, there's been a death of the marriage.
Right.
There's been a death of who they thought their husband was. There's been a death of the dream. You know, so many wives tell me, you know, it's not happily ever after, and my knight in shining armor is rusty. And there's a grieving process that goes on. And grieving for wives is iterative. You know, it happens in a cyclical fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day it can be a picnic and we're happy and hopeful. And 6 minutes later, it can be that she's in a puddle on the floor crying. The next minute, she's throwing heavy things in my direction.
And how do you deal with that? I know many men who are listening are saying, I don't know how to deal with that. I'd rather just head out the door.
Right. Right. Well, and a lot of guys, and what I did too, is I called my wife crazy.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're crazy. What's happening to you? And what's happening to her is she's grieving. So what I try to help guys understand is the best thing that you can do to help your wife heal is give her permission to grieve and practice empathy. And empathy is a muscle that takes working out. Practice the process of having compassion, of putting yourself in her shoes and acknowledging how bad this hurts and what betrayal feels like.
And are your clients able to do that?
With a lot of work, yes.
Okay.
With a lot of work, yes. You know, I rarely see a divorce in my office, even after, whether it's been pornography or affair or multiple affairs.
Okay.
I rarely see that ending up in divorce. There is hope to make it through this.
You know, we talked about shame at the beginning of our conversation, and as the aggrieved party is going in and out of their own grieving process, I would think that the person who sees himself as having created the problem is ripe for feeling boatloads of shame. And how do you climb out of that? How do you stay above that to keep the energy that's needed to go through this process?
That's a great question. I can tell you have been with folks that have been through this journey. And that's a great question.
A couple of times.
I'll tell you, for me, what that took was a couple of healthy, safe men in my life who could be there for me to talk me through the difficulty, to help remind me that there's hope, to remind me that I'm not just a monster and a pervert, to help deal with that shame. What happens for a lot of guys whenever that's activated, their wife is yelling and screaming and angry and hurt,
right.
It activates their shame, and they want to make that pain stop.
Right.
And so they'll get defensive, they'll yell back, they'll explain and justify and excuse. And what I started to learn for myself, what I helped guys in my office do, is realize there's a place where you can get your needs met in a healthy way.
Okay.
You can find the compassion you're looking for in those healthy, safe men that are walking this journey with you. But the person that you've hurt the most on the planet can't give you that compassion right now.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the myths. You talk about them in your book, and one of them that I hear a lot is that time heals all wounds. If you just don't talk about it and you don't do it again, after a while, it'll be okay.
And, you know, in all of the myths, there is some bit of truth. And part of why I wrote about those myths in the book is because I believed them in my own journey. And I thought, well, if we can just get enough distance from this, it will go away.
Mm-hmm.
And there is truth to the fact that with some distance, with some passing of time, the pain will decrease. The memories won't be so fresh. But the wound is always still open. And unless there's proper cleaning out and healing of the wound, it doesn't matter how much time goes by.
Okay.
When salt gets in there's going to be a ton of pain. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. So, of course, the next question is, how do you heal that wound? And that's a longer conversation, I know, than we have time for today. But I think you do a lot to answer that in your book. But what's a reasonable first step, would you say, for somebody who's experiencing the salt in the wound and kind of wanting to not have to go there, but having to go there?
You know, the first step for Shelley and I was full disclosure.
Okay.
The first step was this, and Shelley would tell you, it was when she got full disclosure that she actually knew what she was dealing with. She actually knew what she was going to need to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
She actually knew what she was going to need to work through in terms of grieving. So it started with having all the truth on the table. And the second thing... Oh, go ahead.
I would think that would be hard for you. It would be easy to give her a little bit of the truth and see how she responded to that, and then just decide you were going to keep the rest a secret.
I wrestled for a couple days with that.
Okay.
I absolutely did. And then I came to the realization, and I would say this to any of your listeners who are struggling with secret sins like this, you're only as sick as your secrets. Mm-hmm. And I came to that realization for myself that until I'm fully known, until she knows the truth of what I've been doing, I'm not going to be free, much less have a chance for our own restoration.
Now, you talk a lot about wanting to save the marriage, wanting to restore the marriage. And, of course, for the person who feels harmed, the first thing is, well, he couldn't possibly love me. She couldn't possibly love me. Why would they do this? Either there's something wrong with me, or the sex with me was boring, or they just don't love me.
Mm-hmm.
So how... Talk about how you can love the person you're hurting and how that person needs to think about your behavior as separate from them. Does the question?
Another great question. And we talk about this in the book in terms of the myths. And I'll say this before I answer that directly. If you're a wife listening, and your husband has committed some form of betrayal, sexual betrayal, you need to know, and I would say this for husbands too, most of the time it's this direction in my office, though. If your wife listening, you need to know that it's not your fault. Okay. It's not because of the type of sex or amount of sex or how often you initiate sex. You could lose weight, stop nagging, have a bunch of different sex, and that still wouldn't make a difference because it's not something that you're doing or not doing.
Okay.
This is an issue going on in his heart, in his mind, that you may be the scapegoat for. You may be the excuse and the justification. It is not your fault if your husband's struggling in this way.
I think that's important. It's, at least in my experience, it's really hard for the person who's sitting on the other side of the behavior to hear that and know that. So I'm really glad that you pointed that out.
It is. And for me, what I didn't say in the story is before everything really came to light, about 9 months prior to that, my wife had almost busted me. And so I quasi-confessed. I said, you know what, I've almost cheated on you, and it's your fault.
Uh-huh.
If you would lose weight, stop nagging, have more sex, we wouldn't have any issues. And so when the healing process happened, then I became aware of the reality of ownership that, you know what, it's not because of her. She could have done everything right as a wife. She could have been the most sexually involved with me. It still wouldn't have made a difference. The problem was inside me.
We're going to take a break, folks, and when we come back, we will continue the conversation with Jason B. Martinkus, co-author with Stephen Arterburn of Worthy of Her Trust. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back and we continue our conversation about ways to restore trust in a relationship. Jason, at the point that your wife was able to forgive you, did that mean that everything was now fine, hunky-dory, she trusted you, and it was all good?
Well, I wish. I wish. And that's what I thought, too. I thought we had this sort of ceremony where she sat me down and went through a forgiveness letter and said, you know, I actually have hope that we're going to make it, even though I'm still not sure if I'm staying. And in reality, what happened is I woke up the next morning and felt an incredible amount of pressure. And the reason is because it dawned on me that my wife had just given me a piece of her heart back. And now I had a responsibility to protect it. So not only did things not go away when she forgave me, but actually the ante went up.
What was your next step? If forgiveness does not automatically equal the restoration of trust, and that's clearly what you say in the book, then what? I mean, I know we've got somebody listening who's saying, well, my goodness, if she forgave the man, what? Now what? Now, what else is there to do?
Yeah, what there is to do is, I explain it this way whenever I'm teaching on it, is that, you know, we can't prove what we're not doing wrong. Mm. All we can prove is what we're doing right. And the process of rebuilding trust is one of what I would call paying restitution, where I'm going to now prove what I'm doing right to protect my wife's heart, and beyond that, to help her see that she's going to be better off in this marriage than before we started.
Now, that seems to me to be a really tough mountain to climb, that she's going to get to a place where she feels better off. How do you get there?
In our relationship, what that started to look like was for her to begin to feel like she was the most important person on the planet to me. And some of the ways of going about that I talk about in the book, some of those ways are really pretty simple when you stand back and think about it. It started with simply answering her phone calls, where normally I would send them to voicemail and continue on in my work day. It was as simple as answering a phone call. It was starting to leave her notes to encourage her days. It was being transparent and honest about the way I was spending my days. It was being committed to our counseling sessions and being the one to book those appointments. Mm. You know, there's a lot of little things and kind of low-hanging fruit that she could point to and go, he's doing that right, and he's doing that right, and he's doing that right.
And, you know, the fact that a lot of the things that you were doing, quote unquote, right, were pretty simple things is really important, because many times I think people overlook the weight of the simple, if you will. Answering her phone call when you're used to not answering it, when she's used to going to voicemail and now she can get a real person on the phone, that's pretty big.
It is, and it's not that it's radical or revolutionary. It's just starting to send the message that you're on my mind. You're probably familiar with attachment theory and psychology, and I love a quote from attachment theory that says, security is knowing you exist in someone else's mind.
Yeah.
And I find for wives who have experienced betrayal, that couldn't be more true. Just knowing that their husband is thinking about them and the safety and security of their heart, that in itself is trust building.
Now, I mean, clearly you were going to work and you were coming home and you were, you know, there were still women in the world. How did you and your wife deal with what I imagine would have been any number of her fears? Did he sleep with that one? Did he have an affair with that one?
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with that piece?
Mm-hmm.
Who is she? What does she look like? Where does she live? Why her? Those questions.
Those are painful, painful questions.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned from my counselor in the beginning was to create an open door policy that says any question at any time for any reason.
Okay.
And the reason for that is if my wife is asking questions like, what about her? And did you talk to this woman today? And, you know, those kinds of things. The reason is because she is feeling fear.
Uh-huh.
And if she feels fear, then all of that worry is going to come. If she's going to feel fear, what's going to happen is the questions will will start to arise. She's wondering about the safety and security of her heart. And so having an open door policy to answer any question anytime, even though that might be a painful conversation, the conversation itself would begin to mitigate her fear. That policy is in place today. And I will tell you, even within the last couple months, there's been a moment where she says, Jason, I need to talk to you about something.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question about this, and I feel a little uneasy about it. And I will make the world stop on its axis. I will shut down traffic on any interstate if we're in the car together to make sure that we're going to address that question so that she doesn't have to feel fear.
That's quite a commitment to yourself as well as to your wife and the marriage.
It is. I don't ever want to go back to that hellish prison.
What is the amends matrix that in your book? What is that all about?
The amends matrix was, again, born out of my experience where it seems like no matter how many times I said, I'm sorry, that was never good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no amount of apologizing seemed to help. And so the amends matrix is a tool that I developed to help guys go through the process of actually writing out a situation where there's been a wrong or a transgression, working through and practicing empathy, and then being able to share that with their wives. And what it does, at least in my experience in the office and in my life, what it does is starts to give some texture and some validity back to, I'm sorry I did this. And so I find a lot of guys find it really helpful because they actually have words to say to communicate what's really going on in their heart.
Mm. Is the amends matrix something that you think can be used for any kind of breach in the relationship? Or is it just...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. The matrix is basically saying, here's what's gone wrong. Here's how I can see that it has impacted you. Here's how it impacts me. And here's a vision for the future for it to be different. So, I use that at my house with different things outside of sexual integrity issues as well.
Okay. You said that many wives are victims of spiritual abuse. What do you mean by that? And again, I'm going to ask you to speak directly into the phone. But what do you mean by being a victim of spiritual abuse?
Yeah, so many times I hear from a pastor or a husband even, when it comes to these issues, that they basically use the Bible against these women and their wives. I've heard a wife sit in my office recently and say they went to their pastor after the husband had an affair, and the pastor said, it's probably because you haven't taken good enough care of yourself.
Okay.
And you're called by God to take care of yourself. I have husbands use the scripture that says, you know, your body is not your own. Do not withhold. And if you withhold, that gives me a right to go outside of our marriage. Not only is that abusive relationally, but I would call that spiritual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, what happens for a lot of wives, I see this over and over again, a lot of wives actually believe it.
Yeah.
They believe it. And that's a tragedy.
They believe it, and then they're miserable, and then he's miserable, and then there you are.
Yes. Yes. And I would say for anyone going through this stuff, there is hope. It does not have to be this way any longer. You know, if you're in a relationship where you suspect that stuff's going on, or you know this stuff's going on, take a bold move, take a stand, and say, I refuse for it to be this way any longer. And we're going to get help. You know, it doesn't have to be this way.
You know, I'm thinking about some of the couples that I've worked with where one or both of them has had suspicions that something might be going on. So they follow their partner, they hire a private detective, they do all kinds of things to try to trap him or her in a compromising situation. And my thought is always, if you've got to go that far, then those things aren't going to resolve anything for you. And there's clearly a problem.
You're exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, you're exactly right. If your gut is telling you that there are these types of massive issues going on, get into somebody's office who's a professional and start talking about it.
Yeah.
And don't be the private eye. Don't hire the private eye. Don't jump through all those hoops. Go and start to get help. And eventually the truth comes out. You know, the truth, you know, it always comes out. Starting the process of getting help can start to give you a framework and a landscape for that truth to come out.
Jason, we are just about out of time, but what I'd like to hear from you is perhaps a word or two that you can share with the audience that is of hope.
You know, today, Shelley would say, if she were on this call, she would say, in many ways, what has happened is the best thing that could have happened to me. Because today, this is her talking, she would say, I know myself better. Mm. I know my husband deeply and intimately. Our marriage, because of being where we were so low, we can now strive to make it so much better. And today we're seeing a really sweet redemption in our relationship with absolutely no secrets. For people who are struggling, and I would say specifically for guys who are struggling, you're not a pervert. You're not a monster. There's a reason that you struggle this way. It doesn't have to be that way any longer.
There is hope, and there is help.
Absolutely, 100%.
Jason Martinkus, co-author with Stephen Arterburn of Worthy of Her Trust, What You Need to Do to Rebuild Sexual Integrity and Win Her Back. Thank you so much, Jason, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me, Pamela. It's a privilege to have written something to help people from our experience, and it's a privilege to be on to share our story with folks.
Well, Jason, I'm wondering if there's a website or someplace that people can go for more information.
Sure. Folks can find more information on me and read my story, as well as my wife, on www.redemptiveliving.com. That's redemptiveliving.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Jason. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand at myndtalk.org. So whenever you want to hear this conversation again, that's where you go, mindtalk.org. Managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Social media coordinator Courtney Ebu, thank you very much. And folks, remember that Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And for more information about the program, go to mindtalk.org. And also remember always, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.